From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. Grace of My Heart, a new film by Allison Anders, celebrates the era of the Brill Building, the place in New York City where young, underpaid songwriters worked in cramped cubicles and churned out the great hits of early rock and roll. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we'll hear from some of the best of the Brill Building musicians. Ellie Greenwich co-wrote Be My Baby, Chapel of Love, and Leader of the Pack. Lieber and Stoller wrote for Elvis, The Drifters, and The Coasters. And Carole King wrote One Fine Day, Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow, and Up on the Roof. And critic John Powers reviews the new Merchant and Ivory film about Pablo Picasso. That's all coming up on this archive edition of Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The Food and Drug Administration has issued proposed new guidelines for putting live organs, tissues, and cells from animals into humans. The rules are aimed at preventing the spread of animal infections to people. The guidelines come at a time when physicians are turning increasingly to animal tissue for transplants because of a shortage of human donor organs. Federal statistics show that fewer than 5,000 people each year donate their organs after death, but nearly 10 times that number of people are on waiting lists for transplants. An international monitoring committee is meeting in southern Lebanon today to investigate complaints that Israel and a Hezbollah guerrilla group violated a ceasefire agreement during yesterday's fighting in the region. NPR's Eric Weiner reports.
The five countries who sit on the committee, Lebanon, Syria, Israel, France, and the United States, will look into complaints that both Israel and Hezbollah violated a limited ceasefire agreement that's supposed to protect civilians on both sides of the border. The limited agreement took effect in April after a two-week Israeli offensive into southern Lebanon killed more than 150 Lebanese civilians. The agreement forbids Israel from firing at civilian areas in southern Lebanon and likewise prohibits Hezbollah from using those civilian areas as a staging ground for attacks against northern Israel. Both Israel and Hezbollah accuse each other of violating that agreement during yesterday's fighting, which killed at least three Hezbollah guerrillas and two Israeli soldiers. This is Eric Weiner in Jerusalem.
Police in a Detroit suburb are holding a man taken into custody outside the office of Dr. Jack Kevorkian's attorney, Jeffrey Figer. The man reportedly was carrying a gun and asked workers in the building where he could find Kevorkian and Figer. Authorities in Michigan are considering new charges against Kevorkian in connection with the death of a woman he was counseling. He's been acquitted of assisted suicide charges in three previous trials. The Justice Department is investigating how Microsoft sells its internet software. It wants to determine whether the company is trying to stifle competition. Bloomberg's Alexis Christophorus reports.
Microsoft and the Justice Department are butting heads yet again. Antitrust investigators are probing Microsoft's internet browser business and its program Internet Explorer 3.0. Microsoft will comply with the government's request for information. Microsoft's rival Netscape claims the software giant makes payments under the table to computer makers and internet companies in order to get them to use its browser. Netscape also charges that the software giant is violating terms of a 1994 antitrust settlement. Microsoft blames the flap on sour grapes by competitors such as Netscape, saying they're losing the marketplace battle with Microsoft's Internet Explorer 3.0 software. I'm Alexis Christophorus.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up just over 25 points in heavy trading on this triple witching day. The Nasdaq Composite is up 5.5. This is NPR News from Washington. Ross Perot says he will file a lawsuit today in an effort to be included in the upcoming presidential debates. The Reform Party candidate says the Commission on Presidential Debates violated the constitutional rights of the voters when it recommended last week that the debates be limited to President Clinton and GOP nominee Bob Dole. Perot has challenged Dole to a one-on-one debate next week in St. Louis. Today's morning commute was disrupted for tens of thousands of rail passengers heading into New York City. From member station WNYC, Dick Hinchliffe reports.
At the peak of the morning rush hour, three cars of a Metro North train derailed coming into Grand Central Terminal. Together with the other five cars abandoned, 11 tracks were blocked, or about a third of all the approaches to the station. No injuries were reported. The 1,000 riders on the train were escorted onto an adjacent platform within an hour, but with power turned off to the entire area, the mishap had a domino effect, causing further delays for tens of thousands of commuters on their way to work from New York City's northern suburbs in Westchester and Connecticut. Railroad officials hope that after clearing and inspecting the tracks, rail service will resume to normal operation by this afternoon. For National Public Radio, I'm Dick Hinchliffe in New York.
The National Science Foundation has withdrawn the remaining $14.5 million of a grant to schools in the nation's capital for math and science education because of allegations of mismanagement by school officials. The foundation claims that unqualified people have been selected to run the program. Researchers at the University of California at Davis say both chocolate and red wine could be part of a healthy diet because they contain chemicals believed to help the arteries stay unclogged up. The chemicals are called phenols. They're antioxidants. The findings are reported in the latest edition of The Lancet, a medical journal. The lead researcher says the pairing of red wine and dark chocolate could have synergistic advantages beyond their complementary tastes. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. The plot of the new film, Grace of My Heart, by Allison Anders, is loosely based on the early career of Carole King and her experiences working in the Brill Building in New York City. The Brill Building was headquarters to a lot of top 40 writers. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we're featuring songwriters of that era. We start with an interview Terry Gross recorded with Ellie Greenwich in 1986. Greenwich co-wrote many of the girl group hits of the 1960s, including these.
All the songs we've just heard were co-written by Ellie Greenwich and Jeff Barry, who were briefly married. With the exception of Chapel of Love, which Greenwich and Barry co-produced, all the records we heard were produced by Phil Spector, the first real genius of pop production. Ellie Greenwich also co-wrote Leader of the Pack, recorded by the Shangri-Las, I Want to Love Him So Bad by the Jelly Beans, River Deep Mountain High, recorded by Ike and Tina Turner, Maybe I Know, Leslie Gore, I Can Hear Music, the Beach Boys, and Doo-Wah Diddy, recorded by Manfred Mann. I asked Ellie Greenwich about one of the first hits that she co-wrote and co-produced, Chapel of Love.
That song had originally been cut by the Ronettes. Phil Spector had cut it with the Ronettes, but never put it out. Why? Do not ask me. And we always believed in that song. We knew it had to be a spring release or a summer release because of the nature of, you know, Chapel getting married, June weddings, the whole thing. And what happened was when they did not put that, when Phil Spector didn't put that record out, Jeff and I said, we have to do something with it. And just at that time, a gentleman named Joe Jones came up from New Orleans with a whole slew of people. Amongst them was three girls, which we eventually named the Dixie Cups. And here were all these singers just hanging out at the office, you know, Lieber and Stoller's office. And we said, girls, come here a minute. And we went to the piano, and we played it for them, and they sang. So it's very, I mean, anybody could sing Chapel of Love, you know? And we said, we have to go in and make this record. And it's funny, in my whole career of being in the studio producing, there were only two songs that I literally walked out of a studio and said, either these records are going to be zippity-doo, nothing, go nowhere, or number one records. That was Chapel of Love and Leader of the Pack.
Did you have a special rapport with the singers and the girl groups, being a woman yourself?
I think initially, it's funny, back then, I was not just, well, here's my song, see ya. I got involved in everything. And it wasn't that accepted back then, a female being in that end of the business. A songwriter, a lyricist, automatic acceptance. A background singer, automatic acceptance. A writer, because Carol King and I were really the only female writers then that I know of that actually sat down at the piano and sang a song and really got involved. And that wasn't... But what happened was eventually the girl said, gee, we have someone we can really relate to. Somebody we can talk to. We have headaches today. We want to tell somebody who's going to understand better than Ellie.
What were some of the problems that you had breaking in and getting accepted, being a woman? Because as you just pointed out, there really weren't many women songwriters in the early 60s.
Well, I think I was very fortunate in that most of the early things I got involved in became hits. So what choice did so many of these people have when I said, well, hey, you know, I have a little track record here. This was a hit, and this is doing well on the charts, and I'm doing, you know, and it was almost like, well... We don't love, you know, like the musicians would say, we don't love a woman telling us to go like this on your guitar. But I said, look at me as the thing. Forget, you know. And I think because of my success, it made it a little easier. Plus, I did a lot of co-producing with Jeff. So I had the little male protector on one side. They really didn't have much of a choice, did they?
How did you hook up with Phil Spector?
Oh, this is about a four-hour show. No. I had, at the time, I was writing with a guy named Tony Powers before I was writing with Jeff. And I was not yet signed to Lieber and Stoller, but I was on what they call a first refusal basis. I could use their offices as long as whatever I wrote, they heard first and had first choice whether they wanted it or not. They called me and told me that there was a guy coming up to the office who was cutting the Paris sisters. And did I have something for them? I said, sure. And I went to the office that day, and I'm there, and I'm nervous, and I'm... playing my tune. It was Me Yesterday. He never cut it. This person comes walking in with ruffles, and he's wandering around the room making noises, looking in the mirror. I mean, he was an eccentric human being. Very lovable once you got to know him and work with him, but initially it's sort of like, what is this? Rude to the point of, I kept stopping saying, do you want to hear my song or not? And by the fourth time of him wandering around and making noises and not listening, I got annoyed. And I slammed on the piano and I said, forget it. I mean, forget it. And he, you don't tell Phil Spector, forget it. And he went storming out of the office. And Lieber and Stoller came running and like, what did you do? I said, who was that? I said, that was the most humiliating thing I've ever, I'm singing my heart out. I'm scared to death here. And this guy goes like, he didn't even listen to me. That was the first meeting with Phil Spector. And then I played Lieber and Stoller shortly thereafter a song called Today I Met the Boy I'm Gonna Marry, which they didn't like. And after three times of playing, I said, nah, take it wherever you want. And I brought it to a publisher named Aaron Schroeder. Aaron says, I love it. I want it. I think I know someone perfect to cut this song. And 2 weeks later, he calls me. He goes, we have a meeting. I want you to go to 62nd Street and meet with Phil Spector. I said, does he know who's going to meet with him? And Phil had money, but he didn't connect it with being at Libra and Stella. We had a 2 o'clock appointment. I got there at 2 o'clock. He showed up at 6. And I waited the 4 hours, seething. He walked in, and he took one look at me, and I went, we have, we started off so wrong. And we had it out. I said, if I didn't want this record, I would never have sat here, but I want this record. I think this will be a great song. Blah, blah, blah. Went through it. I said, don't you ever be late again, and don't you make those noises. You listen to me. And he was so taken with the fact that I was like, I mean, I was doing this hysterically, though. I mean, like, I was so upset. But yet I sort of tongue-in-cheeked it because I didn't want to get too serious. We hit it off so perfectly. And that was the beginning of our working relationship. We worked together all the time. And I then was married to Jeff Barry, so I figured, So I brought Jeff in, and then we just, the three of us just really hit it off and just wrote a bunch of songs together.
You were talking about working with Phil Spector and how crazy he was. What's an example of Spector at his craziest?
And I say crazy with tenderness and with respect. I really must clarify that, because people, oh, she called him crazy. He was just so eccentric, and I guess I was so conventional and, you know, from Levittown, Long Island, and, you know, everything was by the book, that anything would have been like a little off, so he was really out there. I think the craziest thing Phil did that I was privy to was going to a recording session once where he had all his musicians wore short sleeve pink shirts with Phil Spector written on it, and stood up and saluted him when he walked in the room. And because most of the artists he cut were black artists, he had everybody stand before the session and sing We Shall Overcome before the date was started. I found that a little, you know, crazy and weird. Also, veering away from the actual studio experiences, we had spent like 3 or 4 days in California writing stuff together, and Phil was petrified of flying. And it was time to come back to New York, and Phil caused such a scene on the plane that people thought it was a bomb scare, and the plane had taken off, came back and landed. We were searched. I figured my parents are going to see me in the paper in jail. They're not going to believe this. But Phil purported to have a heart attack and carried on so crazily, but they said, we got to turn this plane back. And they said, there's this maniac on the plane who's carrying on. So Phil would do things that were just not, you know, overly accepted, especially back then. He was filled with antics. Phil was filled with antics.
One of the big hit songs that you wrote was Leader of the Pack, which you co-wrote. And it was performed by the Shangri-Las, who I always think of as being the tramps of the girl groups, because they had such a tough
You think
image.
They were trampier than the Ronettes? I mean, Terry, please.
Oh. How did you get to work with those Shangri-Las?
Well, there was a guy that I knew named George Morton, whom we, because he was also one that was a little eccentric and like would never show up on time, so we ended up calling him Shadow Morton. So George calls me. He has this tape and a bunch of girls he wants me to hear. Brought the tape to the office, and this thing went on. He did this male narration. It was 7 minutes long. I said, no, we can't do that. But there was something very interesting in this song. Different. I said, who is this singing? This same black thing? You know, I said, wow, it's a very different sound. Saw a picture of them and said, see, that there's where, what an added thing, what an interesting-looking little group here. And met with them, and the record came out. Big hit. It's now time for a follow-up. So Shadow said, we got to write something together. And at that time, when you made money, you bought yourself boots or motorcycles. I mean, that was really what it was all about. So everybody, every male, Jeff, Shadow, the engineer, the arranger, they all had motorcycles, and they were always riding motorcycles. I said, why don't we do something with motorcycles? Okay, we can call it. There's always a leader. The head of the group. I said, no, it doesn't sound good. And we just threw titles around. Leader of the Pack sounded important. And Shadow Morton also had a habit of writing little soap operas. His songs all became these little mini soap operas, right? So with his influence, we melodically did certain things, whatever. And he had this, had to be a 6 song. Let's get, and Jeff had written Tell Laura I Love Her. So he was used to being about with the sick element. This was new for me. I said, hey, as long as it's not too disgusting and I can deal with it. So I think we had everything from the sound effects to motorcycles to boy loving, you know, the girl loving the boy that's forbidden. I mean, all of these, death, my God. I mean, it was like Everything was in there. And once again, like I said, and there's the way Mary sounded, the way the whole group looked, I thought the picture was a perfect picture, and the record was just the perfect kind of a thing to be a top record.
Why don't we hear it? Okay.
Okay.
This is Leader of the Pack, co-written by my guest Ellie Greenwich and performed by the Shangri-Las.
Is she really going out with him?
Oh, there she is. Let's ask her.
Betty, is that Jimmy's ring you're wearing?
Mm-hmm.
Gee, it must be great riding with him. Mm-hmm. Is he picking you up after school today?
Mm-mm.
By the way, where'd you meet him?
I met him at the candy store. He turned around and smiled at me. You get the picture?
Yes, we see.
That's when I fell for the leader of the pack. My folks were all
small. He kissed me goodbye. The tears were beginning to show. As he drove away on that rainy night, I begged him to go slow. Whether he heard, I'll never know.
Look out! I felt so helpless. What could I do?
Ellie Greenwich spoke with Terry Gross in 1986. Greenwich was inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame in New York in 1991. Carole King got her start writing hits for other singers. King will tell us about those days after a short break. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Before Carole King had hit records of her own, she wrote songs that became hits for other singers. Carole King and her first husband, lyricist Jerry Goffin, were one of the most successful songwriting teams of the 60s. Their other hits included Some Kind of Wonderful, Every Breath I Take, Take Good Care of My Baby, The Locomotion, Chains, Don't Say Nothing Bad, and I'm Into Something Good. In the late 60s, King stepped out from behind the scenes and started writing music and lyrics to perform herself.
So far away, doesn't anybody stay in one place? So fine to see your face at my door. Doesn't help to know you're just time away.
That's from King's 1971 album, Tapestry, which remained on the charts for 6 years and broke the record for best-selling album of all time. When Carole King first started writing professionally, she worked with Jerry Goffin at a New York publishing company owned by Don Kirshner. Kirshner is the rock producer who hosted late-night rock concerts on TV and produced The Monkees. I wondered if it was strange to be turning out songs in a cubicle in a Manhattan office building.
Didn't matter where we did it. It was just as easy to do it there as at home, sometimes easier because, we had the kids at home. But also in the office building, just as often, we'd have one of the kids in the room, one of said kids being, of course, Louise Goffin, who has had 3 albums out on her own.
Mm-hmm.
So she got her training really early and on the spot.
So were there like a whole corridor of offices with pianos in them and songwriters new tunes?
It's by now, it's probably fairly well known, the cubicle situation where we would be in one cubicle and say Man and Wild would be in another cubicle and some other team would be in the third cubicle and we'd hear each other trying to write the same song.
Were you given assignments?
Always.
Like, what would an assignment be like?
Well, the Drifters are just coming off a top 10 hit, and we want to get the next one. Donnie Kirshner was really motivated and motivating. You know, he was kind of a daddy figure, I guess, and we really wanted to do it for Donnie. He just, he just kept us motivated and playing off against each other, and it was really fun. It was very competitive, but it was also fun, and the challenge of writing for new people all the time really honed our skills at writing on assignment, doing demos quickly, professionally, and cheaply. Oh, God, cheaply.
Well, the demos are the records that you'd cut for a group who was going to be recording one of your songs, and the demo would show how it's supposed to sound, the melody, the lyrics,
right,
and everything. What makes a good demo?
I don't know. It just has an energy. In many cases, the sounds were really primitive. The performances were flawed. There were scratchy notes on the vocal and wrong notes on the guitar and all that stuff. And tape hiss, because we kept bouncing. At that time, the demos were monaural, one track. That's all we had. And so we just bounced back and forth. So now some of the demos eventually became records because people were telling Kirshner that the demos were so good that he said, more money to be made. Why don't I put them out? So my demo for Bobby V of It Might As Well Rain Until September became my first solo record in that decade anyway. The others before that were not worth mentioning. And Locomotion by Little Eva was in fact a demo for Dee Dee Sharp. And it's funny, you hear it and you hear the drum thing in the beginning, the roll, and before it you hear this enormous amount of tape hiss from the bouncing back and forth from monaural to monaural. But I always liked the fact that they were raw and real, and if there were mistakes and tape hiss, it didn't matter because it was happening.
Carole King spoke with Terry Gross in 1989. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air. More from our archives in the second part of our show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog.
Coming up, the rock and roll songwriting and production team of Lieber and Stoller. They wrote for the Drifters, the Coasters, and Elvis. And critic John Powers reviews the new Merchant and Ivory film, Surviving Picasso.
Well, they said you was high class. Well, that was just a lie. Yeah, they said you was high.
Oh,
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. We continue with interviews from our archives that Terry Gross recorded with great songwriters of the Brill Building era.
Going to Kansas City, Kansas City, here I come.
About 100 different singers recorded that song, from Wilbert Harrison, who had the original hit, to the Beatles and Sammy Davis Jr. My guests are the two guys collecting the songwriting royalties, Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller. This team has written many rock and roll classics for Elvis Presley, the Clovers, the Coasters, the Drifters, and Benny King. Their songs include Hound Dog, Jailhouse Rock, Yakety Yak, Poison Ivy, Searchin', and Stand By Me. They not only wrote the songs, they often produced the records. In fact, Lieber and Stoller were the first rock and roll producers to actually get credit on the record for their work. Rock and roll's greatest producer, Phil Spector, got his start as Lieber and Stoller's assistant. We're going to hear a 1991 interview with Lieber and Stoller. That year, Rhino Records released a CD of their classic songs. It opens with the original 1953 recording of Hound Dog, sung by Big Mama Thornton. This was the first session Lieber and Stoller produced themselves.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog, been snooping around my door. You ain't nothing but a hound dog, been snooping around my door. You can wag your tail, but I ain't gonna feed you no more. You told me you was high.
Well, Jerry Lieber, Mike Stoller, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
The record we've been listening to, Big Mama Thornton's recording of Hound Dog, was your first major hit as songwriters and producers. You wrote the song for her. What was it about her that led to this song?
Well, Mike and I were invited to Johnny Otis's rehearsal studio to listen to and look at some of his artists. Big Mama was one of them, and she was really formidable. She was scary looking. She was big, and she must have weighed about anywhere from 275 to 350, and she had this really guttural, growling sound in her voice. And the both of us fell in love with her, and we just loved what she looked like, and we loved what she sounded like. She sang Ball and Chain, and we decided to take off that minute and go to Mike's house and try to write something for her.
Well, how did you come up with this song, though?
Well, Mike was driving, and I was banging on the roof of the car, and I was trying to come up with something nasty that would be, at the same time, playable, that wouldn't be censored, you know? And the closest I could get to what I was thinking was, you ain't nothing but a hound dog.
So you were thinking four-letter word, epithet, and
right.
You came up with Hound Dog.
Right, which sort of, you know, made it felt right, and it seemed like it would be passable.
Mike, let me ask you how you think Elvis handled the song differently from Big Mama Thornton.
How he handled it differently? Yeah. Well, he handled it very differently. He didn't sing it in the same tradition of blues intonation that Big Mama used. And also, the lyrics were considerably different because Big Mama's, the way the song was written for Big Mama is really about a gigolo. It's a woman complaining about a gigolo. And Elvis couldn't sing that song. So he sang a version of it, which I think, as I'm told, he heard from a lounge act in Las Vegas, that he heard singing the song in Vegas.
Now, you wrote several songs for Elvis, including Jailhouse Rock. Why don't we play a little bit of that?
Swing. You should have heard you knocked out.
Jailhouse Rock, written by my guests Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller. Now, you wrote a lot of songs for Elvis's movies. This was really one of the best songs. Some of the movies had really awful songs in them. Did you have to write some of those awful songs?
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
Oh, we loved writing the awful songs because they were more fun. Things like Steadfast, Loyal and True, you know, songs when he was supposedly graduating high school. I don't think Elvis graduated high school, but maybe he did. But we had to write these terrible songs.
How'd you feel about having to write terrible songs? Why did you enjoy it?
Because it was funny.
Uh-huh.
It was amusing.
Yeah, it was kind of like anti-rock and roll.
Well, the thing was that the problem was this. You got a script, and there would be a moment in a scene where they would want a song. Now, we would tell the director, we would tell Hal Wallace, the producer, we'd say, look, you know, we're not trying to get out of writing a song, but this is really a dumb place for a song, you know? I mean, the guy's about to go into the boys' room and comb his hair, and I don't know why he has to sing, I'm going into the boys' room to comb my hair. And they'd say, we want the song. So we'd write it. So a lot of those songs that shouldn't have been written were written and recorded, and they're there for posterity.
A lot of the songs that you wrote over the years were novelty songs, songs like Charlie Brown, Love Potion Number 9, Yakety Yak, Poison Ivy. I think I just named all Coaster songs here. But how did you get so involved with novelty songs?
We didn't think of them as novelties.
We thought of them dark dramas. We were both trying to imitate Tolstoy and Dickens, and I guess we just fell short of the mark. We wrote novelty songs because we're both essentially gag writers, and we like to tell funny stories and anecdotes. And this is just a way of telling funny stories set to music.
Well, let me play one of your novelty songs that's on that's on the Rhino Records anthology. And this is Charlie Brown.
Fee, fee, fi, fi, fo, fo, fum. I smell smoke in the auditorium. Charlie Brown.
Everybody always picking on me.
That's him on his knees.
I was wondering if one of the reasons why you wrote so many novelty songs is had to do with that you were two white Jews writing for a lot of R&B groups who were black. I don't know how self-conscious you were about that, but I was thinking, well, maybe it was easier in a way to write songs that were funny as opposed to maybe the presumptuousness of writing something that was really heartfelt when you were writing for other people. Though you wrote a lot of those songs, too.
Well, to begin with, these two white Jews really experienced themselves as black. I was brought up in an essentially predominantly black neighborhood in South Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
And Stoller can speak for himself, but he went to interracial camps when he was a kid. No, it's not that. We really felt that we were very black, and we acted black, and we spoke black. And it wasn't really till later on, when you hear these later songs, like 1959 and 60, the late Coasters things,
mm-hmm.
that are really kind of generalized rock and roll for mass market. But the early stuff that we wrote things like, our early songs were not really novelty. They were blues. Hound Dog is a buck dance blues for Big Mama. And Kansas City is a 12-bar blues, certainly not a novelty song. All the early stuff, with Jimmy Witherspoon.
And Hard Times that we wrote for
Charles Brown. These are all blues. And we wrote exclusively for black artists because that's how we felt. And it wasn't until later on that we started to stretch a little bit. And when we moved actually from L.A. to New York, started to write for a broader market.
We'll be back with Lieber and Stoller after a break. This is Fresh Air. Do you Harry Lieber and Mike Stoller are my guests. Now, after you were writing songs for a while, you started producing the records of the people who were doing your songs. This was in the days before record producers were considered to be the auteurs of, you know, of the music industry. Why did you get into the production? Why did you want that control?
Well, self-defense, really.
We needed to protect the intention of our work because we had had a few experiences early on where we would deliver a song on a piece of paper and it didn't come out the way we had intended it at all. It was another aesthetic entirely.
Give me an example.
And in order to make it sound the way we planned to make it, we had to do it ourselves.
For instance, we'd come in with what we thought was like a sort of a Texas shuffle, you know, a blues.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be on paper, and we didn't have a demo, and they would turn it over. Because we were somewhat hot, they'd take it that way, and they would turn it over to an A&R man, say at Capitol or at CBS, whatever. And these were good producers, but they had their own sense of what was correct and what was happening, and they weren't down into rhythm and blues. They were still rooted in swing and jazz at that time. And they would, you know, we would have something that should sound like either a Texas pickup band or Memphis Slim, and they would make a record that would sound like Tommy Dorsey or Benny Goodman's swing band, and it would just be wrong. And so after a couple of these disappointments, we decided to, in self-defense, to learn how to produce records ourselves so we could make our songs come off the way they were intended.
One of the things that you are famous for having pioneered was bringing a string section to rock and roll or to rhythm and
blues.
That
was Mike's fault.
Yeah, let me ask you, you know, on the Drifters recording of There Goes My Baby, that's the classic example of you bringing strings on. What went through your mind to do it?
I can tell you exactly what was on my mind. Just the line, the melodic line. And I was playing it. I used to joke about this one because it sounded like Borodin and I sounded like one of the Caucasian melodies. And
I don't know if you get the pun, but he's been saying this for many years, and I always thought it was funny.
Right.
The fact that he would use a Caucasian melody on this.
But it was right. Jerry heard it, and he said, that sounds like strings. And I said, why not? And so why not? We had five violins and one cello. And they were all basically playing in unison.
Because Jerry Wexler wouldn't spring for six violins and two celli.
Was it hard to find string players who could play with the right spirit on a session with the Drifters?
No, they didn't have to play with the right spirit. They just had to play a Caucasian melody. And so we hired a lot of Caucasian string players.
Now, another thing that happened on this record was you introduced a Latin rhythm.
The Bayonne rhythm was one that both Jerry and I adored. It was I first heard it in the film Anna with Silvana Mangano. And they had a small Brazilian group. And the record Anna became a fairly big hit, and it was a popular melody. And I just loved the rhythm on it. And we had always looked for a place to use it. We'd used it maybe once before on a early record that was not particularly successful. And we had the opportunity to use it on this record date. And there happened to be a timpani left over from another recording session in the studio. And we used it. Now, the drummer was not a percussionist. He was just a trap drummer, and he didn't know how to use the tuning pedal on the timp. So he played one note throughout the entire thing, which gave it a rather bizarre, muddy bottom with all kinds of weird overtones. It was kind of fascinating, though. And that's where we first had a successful use of that Bayonne rhythm, which, in case anybody's wondering, is boom, 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 boom.
Which finally was used, I think, and is responsible for maybe over 1,000 hits, because this Brazilian rhythm supports a slow ballad without the ballad seeming to be slow or sluggish. It keeps it moving. And everyone from Burt Bacharach to Phil Spector to you name it have leaned heavily on the support of this rhythm pattern.
Our interview with Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller was recorded in 1991. We opened the show with a recording of Be My Baby, which was co-written by today's first guest, Ellie Greenwich. We're about to hear from the singer who made that song a hit, Ronnie Spector of the Ronettes. My interview with Ronnie Spector was recorded in 1987. You know that Bayonne rhythm that Lieber and Stoller talked about popularizing? Here it is again. Hear the song. Did the songwriter sing it for you before you performed it the first time?
Well, the first time I heard it, you know, Phil and those were, and Ellie Greenwich and Jeff Barry, we met in a little studio, and they started writing around me, and I guess I was 16 years old and very shy, and I liked Phil at the time, and he liked me. I think they wrote it all around that. You know, our little love affair at the beginning. I think it was all a part of that.
Do you remember the recording session?
Like it was yesterday.
What was it like?
It was incredible, because there I was in California recording, and I'd never left New York. I'd never been out of New York in my whole life. And there I am on a plane going to California by myself without the other two Ronettes, just to do the lead part. And I loved it. I love it till today. I still love it. I mean, it's just a record that I remember that day being in the studio. I remember what color dress I was wearing. I remember everything.
One of the things you do on this record is your famous, I can't even imitate this, but your famous "Whoa-oh."
Yes.
How did you come up with that? Was that something you just started singing?
No, it was like Frankie Lyman used to sing, "Why do birds sing so gay? And love is away with break of day. Why do they fall in love?" And so I sort of got it from him, and it was like my own little ho-ho's came out. And I think it's just something that I started, and it stuck.
You formed the Ronettes with two of your cousins when you were all teenagers.
No, a sister and a cousin.
A sister and a cousin, okay. And how did you learn to sing harmonies?
Actually, it was like a bunch of cousins. I had so many first cousins. It was like three other girls besides the two Ronettes, and it was a boy cousin singing lead, and it just sort of narrowed down to one. And I remember the three of us being on the rooftop, like learning routines, because we never had a choreographer or anything. We sort of did what the street dances and stuff, and we just made it three. It was a family, and we had a sort of strict upbringing. So we couldn't go out, and we could look out in the street and watch other girls walk and everything, but we couldn't go out. So we stayed in the house, and that's how we all just started singing.
You broke into the music business by being a dancer at the Peppermint Lounge, being a dancer on the Murray the K Show,
right.
Singing backup vocals. Did you do things in those early days to help get yourself noticed? Did you either like dress in such a way as to call attention to yourself? Okay, what'd you do?
First of all, you have to have a gimmick in this business, we figured. And so we wore our hair extra high, you know, the beehives in the 60s, and we wore eyeliner, you know, like Chinese eyes almost, and we wore slits up the side of our dresses because we sang and danced. when we had a lot of aunts. My mother has like six sisters, and so that's seven of them dressing us, and they told us to put a cigarette in our mouth. And we stood outside the Peppermint Lounge, dressed just alike. And I was so glad, because at 14 I was smoking. They just didn't know it. And it was great because we stood online and we had to look older, so we had to exaggerate everything because all of us were underage.
Now, you know, it always made me think that you were really tough, really streetwise.
No.
Where, you know?
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, when we heard about people being junkies or dope addicts, I would ask my mother, well, let me see one, because the way my family would talk about them, it was like it was a disease, because I was very young and I didn't know. So I wasn't a tough streetwise kid at all, but we just did all the dances, and I loved it. From the time I was 3 years old, when my whole family applauded me, I remember the song was Jambalina Cove, Spine of Gilly Gumbo. Cause tonight I'm gonna meet Mom Shadow Mio. Pick a spot filled with Guy and Miguel. Son of a gun, we're having fun on the bayou. And I think that's when I got my ho 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 ho. And then my family just started applauding me, and I was like 3 years old. And I said, that's what I want to be the rest of my life. I want to perform.
Ronnie Spector, recorded in 1987. Coming up, critic John Powers reviews the new film about Picasso. This is Fresh Air. Surviving Picasso, starring Anthony Hopkins, is the latest film from Birch and Ivory Productions. The story covers the 10-year relationship between Picasso and Francois Jalot, who was 40 years his junior. Film critic John Powers says the filmmakers may have gotten Picasso's story right, but they don't capture the appeal of the man.
When the public is asked to name a 20th century artist, the most common reply is always Picasso. A man renowned both for his painting and his billy goat sexual appetite. Picasso went through women as other men go through bottles of wine, leaving them empty, if not broken. There was one exception. Her name was Françoise Gillot, and she's the heroine of Surviving Picasso, an embarrassingly trivial new movie about what it meant to love the great Pablo. The young British actress Natasha McElhone plays Françoise, an art student who meets the 63-year-old Picasso in Nazi-occupied Paris. Swept away by his charm and her own desire to be a painter, she becomes his mistress, supplanting his current lover, Dora Maar, who's nicely played by Julianne Moore. Françoise joins the long line of women destined to be Picasso's bedmate, muse, and victim. She's initially thrilled just to bask in his affection and orbit his genius. But over the next decade, as she bears two of his children, she discovers that he's something of a sacred monster who uses everyone around him, then casts them aside when they stop serving his needs. Surviving Picasso was made by producer Ismail Merchant and director James Ivory, a team best known for its adaptations of novels like Howard's End. They've recently begun doing movies about historical figures, and the results can only be termed disastrous. Last year's Jefferson in Paris turned Thomas Jefferson into a waxwork dummy whose major accomplishment seems to have been sleeping with one of his slaves. Here they treat Picasso as a sexist clown, and Françoise is the heroine of a harlequin romance. Her story has a laughably breathless tone, as when she first tells her grandmother, played by Joan Plowright, that she's moving in with Picasso.
He's had 100 lives already, and the whole world knows how many women he's destroyed. I couldn't bear it for you, darling.
Do you really think I'd let myself be destroyed by a man, even if he is Picasso?
Well, I don't understand you. It's going against nature. You are so young. And he's old. It's as if you've taken a wrong turning.
No. For the first time, I feel that everything is right. That I'm turned in the right direction. I'm sure. I'm so sure. I've never been so sure of anything in my whole life.
Then it doesn't matter what I say. Except I love you. And whatever happens, I love you.
Good night.
Don't go and live with him, Françoise. Remember, these years won't come back again. If you waste them, they're gone.
Movies about artists are hard to pull off, because the essential thing, artistic inspiration, is the one thing that's impossible to film. It's invisible. What is visible is the external reality of an artist's life. Thus, the recent film Basquiat is far more about the workings of the 80s art world than Jean-Michel Basquiat's inner life or his work. And the same is true of Surviving Picasso, which is ultimately little more than gossip swaddled in a veil of high-mindedness. A marvelous actor, Anthony Hopkins would seem perfect for showing us the boundlessly creative Picasso, who liked to compare himself to a minotaur, half man, half bull. But Hopkins hasn't been allowed to capture his character's animal ferocity or his brilliant, terrifying grandeur. We learn even less about François Gillot, who spends the whole movie either beaming or frowning at Picasso's antics. She's a cipher. Although this is really her story, we never learn her deepest feelings, how she behaves with her children, or how she develops as an artist. If Surviving Picasso has a point, it's the familiar one that genius and virtue are not the same thing. You can be simultaneously a great artist and a truly rotten human being. Yet it also shows, perhaps unwittingly, that time is kinder to genius than to virtue. Although Gillot is an admirable woman, the only reason anyone still cares about her story is for the light it sheds on the man who changed the way that we all look at the world. What truly survives Picasso is not the gossip about his bad behavior, but the art that this movie ignores.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Our engineers this week are Audrey Bentham and Fred Snyder. Joan Tui Westman produced today's show. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.